He was the first one who came up with even the concept of a Shia LaBeouf.
Exactly.
Welcome to Sincast, presented by CinemaSins.
Everybody, welcome to the Sincast. This is Chris Atkinson from CinemaSins, joined as always by the voice of CinemaSins, Jeremy Scott.
Yeah, baby.
And from Music Video Sins, Barrett Sher.
You're the man now, dog.
Dog, the man.
Yeah, you know, classic Finding Forrester quote from Barrett there.
It's crazy how many he's Connery always quoting quotes. Connery has a lot of quotes from shitty movies, but the quotes, like, I'm the last one from that Dragon movie.
Yep.
And, like, I think it's just that his voice is so iconic, it's fun to say things.
You're banished. Losers always whine about their best. Winners go home and fuck the prom queen.
And we'll always remember, I come at you now at the turn of the tide. Oh, that's probably a sore spot for Sean Connery.
Oh man.
So today we're finally getting to the Discord questions.
Question.
I got something to say.
I want the truth.
I am listening.
Discord.
We have ignored them, not because we hate you, Discord, but because we love you. Because every time the questions were coming in, they would come into Facebook and I would pile them up and send them to Barrett. And then I don't think we were aware of a question section for a while. And then I was aware, but forgot about it. And it's all on me.
I forgot all about it.
And I even brought it up on this podcast when we did a Q&A. And said, we're going to have to do that. And then we did another Q&A and didn't do Discord.
We are sons of bitches.
We get a lot of questions, folks. And it's awesome.
But this will forever be a source now for us to take a look at. And these are some good questions that have rolled in. And we will attempt to answer them.
I love the Discord community, by the way. Now, I will admit that I am not... The most app savvy person on our team. From what I've read with Discord and experiences with Discord, it's fantastic. Especially the community that we have, very much like the community that we have on our subreddit, very much like the community that we have in other of our social medias, our Twitter buds. We really do have a community, and Discord is one that I finally jumped in. Wholeheartedly, and have really come to love.
And appreciate.
So yeah, I'm excited.
All right. So what did we find in the Patreon question section that we're gonna answer today, Barrett?
It's like mining for gold, and here's the first nugget.
Hmm.
Man, this is such a cool, interesting question. What does the future of science fiction look like? We already have supercomputers / AI, robots that walk through open doors and use swords, advanced medicine / artificial limbs, billionaires going to space, will be mining comets, future will be alien franchises, Star Trek, pandemics, global warming, Earth dying. Will we look at today's sci-fi like we look at 1920s sci-fi and the fact that it's outdated?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think it's a fascinating thing to discuss. I don't think there's any right answer, obviously, because we're predicting the future. But I think science fiction writers will always be daydreaming about the things we can't do.
Sure.
So even though we have things that we can do, and all of those things he listed are some mixture of amazing and terrifying, specifically the robots, dogs that bark and shoot bees at you. But you know, whatever our limitations are as a species, science fiction will always live outside of that, and probably influence where we go with our actual technological drive. My My long-term answer is that I think everything is a pendulum. So I think centuries from now, once we have conquered all possible tech, the drive for humanity will be to go in the other direction, to go Swiss Family Robinson and get back to nature and not let tech control us so much. If we can avoid a robot-human war in the middle of all that, that'd be awesome. Mm-hmm, But, you know, I think there's something... I don't know. I love science fiction. I write short stories about it. And I'm always looking at the world beyond our current reach and abilities.
But you think that could come back around to the other side? Like when Isaac Asimov classically wrote a Will Smith character that's really into Mustangs and Converse in his iRobot book or story, right?
I don't remember that story super well.
He said something. He was the originator of the Fresh Prince in iRobot.
Yeah.
It was one of the rules of robot technology, I believe.
Sure. I mean, his code word was West Philadelphia.
Mm-hmm. And then, where he was born and raised, yeah.
Yeah, right. And then Shia LaBeouf came in.
He was the first one who came up with even the concept of a Shia LaBeouf.
Exactly. What kind of LaBeouf you think? It's a Shia.
Yeah, exactly.
No, I think it's hilarious that that sci-fi writers a lot of times put in anachronistic characters or characters that are obsessed with anachronisms, like Will Smith not being, I say Will Smith, but the main character in iRobot being obsessed with, like, you know, old school stuff and not into this newfangled technology.
Well, even in Oblivion, which I just watched recently, Tom Cruise has that little cottage on the lake in the mountains with the record player and the books. And he likes, that's his getaway. But he lives in the most high tech. I mean, there's a lot more going on in this movie than just this, but he lives in the most high tech thing possible, right? So what he dreams about is getting away from that. And I think eventually as a species, that will be what we do. It'll be probably centuries. And I just hope it doesn't come because of some Armageddon, like global warming related or meteor hitting the earth it would be awesome if we could just get there with our own brains and be like, yeah, maybe we don't need all this. I'm skeptical.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I would be arrogant to say that people would not look back on sci-fi being written today, wouldn't find it primitive 100 years from now. The one thing, this question is a little loaded because the science fiction of the 1920s and even before, if you're going into the Jules Verne era and all that, they've come up with some things that were pretty fantastical back in their era that have come to fruition and everything. I don't know if I think maybe we more look back at it and laugh because it's out of date technology. It's not nearly as advanced, but the concept is still there. And I feel like most of the concepts that we have out there have been written about. It's just a matter of how we present that technology in science fiction and everything. There are a couple of problems. There's more than a couple of problems, but there are several problems that, science has yet to figure out that we think if we had certain technology, we could do it in theory, and we haven't figured those things out yet, so that maybe in 2080 whatever we're 2080 we're flying around the speed of light in these giant ships somehow, some way, because we discovered something insane. But I'm sitting there, I look back at like something like the Terminator, which was 37 years ago, and we look back at it as kind of funny because the visual effects are funny. And we have robots that can, that can obviously murder people. I mean, we know this. We've seen this.
We know.
And the, they, but it that technology still doesn't seem entirely out of date, right? Like that seems right. still futuristic, even though that's currently happening. We're making the robots that will eventually kill us, but it doesn't, it's not something you should look back at 37. Now that's only 37 years though. Only quote unquote, mm-hmm. 37 years. And of course, you know, killer robots had been before that too, but they were even more antiquated then. You Westworld, but robots and stuff like that, even older than that. And then, what was it? The old Twilight Zone where, was it, what's his name? That's in that, like one of the first ones who kept calling it a robot. Jack Warden is in that Twilight Zone episode. So yeah, I think a lot of things that we currently can imagine, like all the stuff that can be imagined as far as like what we could do with space travel and medical advances and everything, that's probably been thought of, but we don't know what it's going to look like. So it will look antiquated to somebody 100 years from now. So I don't, that's one of the questions that I have in there. Like, is it coming up with something brand new? That's hard, right? Mm-hmm. Something absolutely no one has ever thought of before. Yeah. But thinking of it in a way that actually makes sense, that's the part where in 2080 you're going to be going, ha, ha, the Terminator, they thought robots were going to kill like that.
yeah. Instead of just, you know, frying them from 20 miles away.
Right, exactly.
It's a fine line for writers and I guess filmmakers too to make it a believable date, right? Of mm-hmm. course, 2001 is an interesting example because at the time that Kubrick and Arthur C. Clarke wrote it, 2001 seems like forever, and mm-hmm. here we are in 20 years later. Mm-hmm. The same goes for, you know, Back to the Future Part 2 and all that stuff, you know, all these things where, and Jeremy, you've written a bunch of sci-fi stuff. Like, do you need to set it way into the future to where there's no way that people will look back at this and say, like, are you fucking kidding me? 2015, you know, we're not in flying cars or hover. Well, actually we do have hoverboards, but like, you know, that kind of thing, 3D sharks coming out of the marquee and all that stuff. Or can you keep it, keep the principles muted like there are in Her, right, where it's set in the near future and you can see those little angles of near future stuff, but it's not overtly flying cars and crazy shit like that? Or does it even matter for you?
Well, the best example, I think, is Children of Men, because that's set, I think, in like 2037 or something. Mm. But there's nothing, even though there's visual stuff in the world building of that movie, there's nothing that when we get to 2045, I don't think we're going to look at Children of Men and go, oh man, they thought buildings would have newspapers on their windows. What dumbasses. So yeah. And Her is another good example, but you know, you get something like Demolition Man. I mean, again, I think if you love a movie, you know, eventually 2001 becomes just the title of the movie to me, yeah. and not me remembering that they were predicting tech for that year from the 70s mm-hmm. or 60s or whenever. Like Back to the Future too. I'm not pulled out of that movie, so to speak, because the tech predictions were wrong. It's just a vision of the future.
And also yeah. you can pull up needles on a big old fucking wall video chat if you want to.
Right. Mm-hmm. But yeah, mm-hmm. some of it got right. I still would like to hydrate a pizza in like 20 seconds.
Right.
Yeah, that's a Fifth Element thing too, by the way, where she puts the thing in the microwave, the turkey dinner or whatever the fuck.
Yeah.
For a half a second, all of a sudden she's like, whoa.
Well, and let's not forget that Minority Report, nearly everything that's in that movie is, except for the cars driving alongside buildings and shit like that.
But self-driving cars, we're almost there.
We're almost there. Being able to read your retinas and be like, this was great. That I told y'all about this. It was last night as of this recording. Went into a parking lot that I had been in before, and my phone texted me from the parking company that said, welcome back. I had not even gotten out of my car yet to do anything. And it was just like, oh, you were here before. Let's go ahead and start charging your credit card. This is awesome, right? This is amazing, right?
We are, I mean, there are billboards that can RFID certain cars approaching and change what the advertisement is based on that. Mm-hmm. Minority Report got a lot of things right. And that's as much, was that Philip K. Dick?
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, as it is Spielberg, right? Mm-hmm. I haven't read the story, so I don't know.
I'm assuming most of that is Philip K. Dick.
Yeah,
coming up with a lot of that stuff.
Yeah, I would think so. Yeah, what a fun topic! I could probably do a whole episode just on just discussing the various things about science fiction and movies that got it right and movies that got it wrong. And
I mean, we obviously will in 2080. You know, none of us will be here in 2080 unless technology gets to a certain point where they can figure out how to cure 17 stab wounds. But
that's how you're gonna go out.
That's how we're going to go out. Nice little Simpsons nugget there.
Nice.
Yeah. Because I mean, think about just 15 years ago, right? Where the idea of having an iPhone was ridiculous. I guess it was around 15 years ago that the first iPhone came out. And then all the advances that have come on with all the different companies that have come out. I mean, you can do almost anything with your phone at this point.
Yep.
So yeah, I mean, just 15, and then take 15 years off of 2006. I mean, people in 1991 are looking at 2006 going, holy fuck, look at all the shit, all the shit you can do. So exactly. Even 15 years, we're going to be looking back at 2021 and going, wow, that was a horrible time in history for us.
1994. I was home on break from college, and I made a video for my girlfriend, and I did the whole two VCRs editing system, right? You've done this?
Nice. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Where, like, one VCR is recording the other VCR, and that's how you... And that, if you'd have shown me Adobe Premiere back then, man, I would have punched you in the face. Yeah. I called you a witch.
Yeah. Although Adobe Premiere did exist back then.
I'm sure it did.
You just couldn't afford it.
No. Yeah.
That's the thing.
I think even digital video cameras existed at that point.
Mm-hmm.
What was that? What do they call them? Camcorders is when they started calling them camcorders instead of like those big shoulder mount fucking things you used to have to use, which is what I was using.
Yeah. Well, and look at movies too. I mean, that's the other thing. A lot of the things that this is an old discussion too, but a lot of the things that you think are brand new have had some version of it for way longer than you realize.
Right.
You look at some of the movies of the 60s even, and they're like talking about using computers to do this and that and the other thing, and you're like, Jesus Christ, they're talking about it back in the 60s. I didn't even know they had computers back in the 60s. You know,
that that video I made for my girlfriend, by the way, consisted of me going around the mall asking strangers what their favorite cuss words were. And when I was editing it together, I got one gal at Claire's Boutique. I think it was Claire's Boutique who just immediately said, fuck. Yeah. And I edited it together. So it's me going, what's your favorite cuss word? And then she goes, fuck, mm-hmm. fuck. That is a glimpse into 19-20-year-old Jeremy's mind.
Oh, and not only did you, now you're using the two VCR method, which means you also had to account for the 5-second run back every time you stopped the tape.
Yes.
Which was the fucking worst.
It was not very clean edit, I will admit, but
so there might have been times like, what is your favorite cuss word? And it's like, it. And then,
exactly right.
Let's get on to the next one. This was a great first question.
Yes. Oh, and this is a great second question. I love this. What character in a movie did you cheer for getting murdered horribly? Murder. You know
what's great about this question is they don't actually have to have been murdered horribly for you to have wished it.
That's true. You just enjoyed it. You cheered for it.
Yeah. A Morton Joe in Mad Max Fury Road. I think that's like ultimate, ultimate evil vanquished. I was very happy he died.
Was that, did Furiosa rip his mask off, or was it Max? It was Furiosa, wasn't it?
I thought it was Rosie Huntington Whiteley or one of those.
One of his wives.
One of his wives that did it. I think I could be wrong. It could be Furiosa, but I thought it was one of them because that was what made the most sense. They were the victims of him.
Yeah, for sure.
Biggest victims of him. I also have Nitty in The Untouchables.
Yes.
Nice.
He's in the car.
Yeah. Especially, I mean, they really set him up pretty well after he kills the Connery character. And then he's like, your friend died. It's like a little pig.
And squealing like a stuck Irish pig.
Yeah, exactly.
Did he fall off the building?
He did.
Well, yeah. He had a little help from
he had a little accident. But yeah, there's even a point where Costner is holding on to him and he thinks that he's going to pull him up and then he just lets him go like badass.
Yeah, yeah.
Also, this one's going to be unpopular and I want to have a disclaimer. I am not saying this guy should die for any other reason than he's being annoying in this movie, but the dude in the wheelchair in Texas Chainsaw Massacre was very happy that he died.
Oh, the one of the kids, right?
He's always complaining. Yes. He's always yelling for his sister. And look, he's right, probably. He's absolutely probably right to be the way he is in this movie. But when you're sitting there watching Texas Chainsaw Massacre and he keeps saying his sister's name over and over and again because he wants something or he's complaining about something, I was kind of glad he died. Yeah. I'm glad you did.
Oh man, I should have thought more about this. You had such great answers there. Matt Damon in The Departed. Because until he dies, he's gotten away with it. And that I can't abide that.
Why is everybody in his building pissed off at him? I forget.
Because he's an asshole.
I brought up the same question, I believe, on a previous Sincast. I was like, I understand that he's the bad guy, but how do they know that
we
he
know.
Is?
Unless
Mark Wahlberg went around the building and said, you know that guy in 203? He's an
totally
asshole.
Totally something Digman would do, by the way.
he went into your house and he played with your panties while you were gone. You know, some bullshit.
Here's my theory. I think he's lived there long enough. He all movie long, he gives off asshole vibes in little ways, right? Like when they bring the dessert at the restaurant, he mocks it. He's like, how the fuck am I supposed to eat this thing? When he's on the elevator before he even meets the girl, he holds the doors open for like a minute and 30 seconds while he flirts with this girl, and everybody in the elevator just has to take it. Now, if you lived in an apartment building with that guy, this has probably happened before,
and you've
already gotten the vibe, this guy's an asshole. That's my theory. Mm-hmm.
Or they all heard the recording that Leonardo DiCaprio gave. They all got a copy of
sent to the people in your apartment. It's fucking cold, yo. He plays that part perfectly though, because he's still almost likable. Like throughout all that shit. Like because he's Matt Damon, you still kind of have a soft spot for him, but he's such a dickhead. He gets these little subtle jabs at him, like he can't get it up with Vera Farmiga.
Yeah, and he comes in straight away, and when she's trying to put up pictures of her and everything, she's like, "Oh, you know, I care about who you are, just not around the apartment," you know.
I also put down Bradley Whitford in Cabin in the Woods, but only for comedy's sake. I mean, I don't know that he's probably done enough evil. He probably does deserve to die in the grand scales of justice, but it's the method by which he's going to die, and it just brings me glee. Because he finally gets
what
to
is
see
his
him
last his last line is like, are you fucking kidding me or something,
Like that. Yeah.
Because he's always wanted to see the merman.
It's It's such and the a merman ends up killing thing. Him. Like you can hear the thump, and it goes all blurry to clear, and he's like, "What?" Yeah. Arguably, that's his best moment, right? Where, yeah. like, in his life, where he's, he finally sees it. But yeah, he gets.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
That's it for me. What do you got, Barrett?
All right. So, what a manipulation that the Revenant does, because. Mm. Tom Hardy is the villain in The Revenant, as the movie portrays him. Mm-hmm. And then that final fight between Hugh Glass and his character is so visceral, and so it takes goddamn forever. Everybody's mm-hmm. cut up. Everybody's like all fucking bloody and shit like that. And you've already endured a ridiculous amount of violence and pain to this point in this movie. So when he finally does... gets scalped. Well, no. Yeah. So he gets essentially mortally wounded, and Glass sends him down the river, and then he gets taken by the, is it the Krees? Taken by the Native Americans, it's so satisfying because the hero of the story has won the day. The big thing with Tom Hardy's character is his treatment of the, Hugh Glass's kid. Mm-hmm. I don't think he's necessarily wrong to let Glass die and go on their way, because otherwise maybe the rest of them are going to die, which I think a lot of them do anyway. But but given the heel turn at the end of that movie and that fight, man, you're just happy to see him go, and especially to go at the hands of the Native Americans that he's been so racist and awful to, this entire time. That is satisfying. Am I wrong? I know we all love that character, but we're all glad to see him go, right?
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah. Yep. Oh yeah.
Yep.
Oh yeah.
I mean, they had to manufacture a reason for, cause that real story, none of that Native American stuff happens. So,
right. All right. Yeah. Yeah.
So they had to manufacture a reason for him to be so hateful in it. So yes, definitely. I wanted to see him die very slowly.
Well, I'll tell you what, immediately when I think about this, I think about, and it, there was a million movies that popped into my head that I couldn't, or moments that I couldn't place the movies, where somebody finally kills the killer and the music cuts, the dialogue cuts, everything cuts. And you just hear him go, ah!
Yeah.
An example of that would be, and this is not somebody I wanted to die, but the example of that would be fucking Jeff Bridges shooting Ben Foster in Hell or High Water. Mm-hmm. Where he has that moment of celebration and realization of all the shit that has happened on this. Now, Ben Foster should die in that movie. He is objectively not a good person and not a good, he's a great character. He's just not a good character. There's stuff like that. But, the one that really popped out was when Brody finally kills the shark in Jaws. Because, his shit's fucked up, man. At this point, fucking Quint is dead. Fucking Mr. Holland's dead. Fucking, he's going into the ocean. He's got literally one fucking shot left.
He didn't die. Mr. Holland didn't die.
In his mind, he thinks. He thinks he's gone.
Mr. Holland.
Yeah.
Bob Rumson.
Bob Rumson died.
Dr. Leo Mervin.
Shouting off Richard Pryce. Always dies. When he finally gets that shot, and not only does Bruce die, he gets blown to smithereens apparently. And that moment on Roy Scheider's face where he's just like, ah!
Oh, I know, it's such a great moment.
God, it's such a great moment.
It gives me chills to you even bringing it up.
Oh, it's so good. And then the last one is that even though Hans Landa doesn't die at the end of Inglourious Bastards, which we were talking about before the show started, that ending is so perfect because he has defected. He thinks he's got this whole thing figured out and he's going to just live out his life as a non-Nazi, even after all the atrocities that he has done.
Mm-hmm.
And rather than, you could say, give him the easy way out of just killing him, Aldo Raine says, this is going to be my masterpiece, and carves a fucking swastika into his head. And that is, very satisfying to me. You know, Hitler being killed in the actual story is fantastic. The Manson family getting mangled at the end of Once Upon a Time in Hollywood is satisfying. But I think the Hans Landa character being forever marked is such a brilliant idea. And I think that was,
well, and also goes back to the question, right? It allows you to say that you wanted to see him die horribly, even though he didn't.
Mutilated. I'm glad. I'm happy.
Mm-hmm.
I'm happy.
Yeah.
Get out there, Hans. Fucking asshole. All right. You want the next one?
No.
This one's going to be fun. This person was just watching Hellraiser.
Wow.
And wow, was his brother and wife a pair of a-holes. Sir, I need you to watch your language.
Dude, it was funny. When I first read this question, I didn't see the A there. So I was like, pair of holes. And I was like, you know what? We should say this more often. You're such a hole. Or, you know, there's something about it, man. There's something about it that I like. So what a hole.
Yeah, what a hole. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Who's a hole?
Anyways, brother and wife were a pair of a-holes. I have seen Hellraiser. I don't remember that, but I'm sure this person is right. What is the movie with the worst family members and or spouse?
Mm-hmm. For me, it's Neil Perry's parents in Dead Poets Society.
Oh, yeah.
Robert Sean Leonard, is it?
Robert Sean Leonard plays Neil Perry, and Kurtwood Smith plays his dad. Kurtwood Smith, obviously, back in this era, was always playing the stern asshole guy.
Yeah.
I don't think he's more of an asshole in this movie than he is in RoboCop, and he kills people in RoboCop.
Yeah.
Mm. But think about the pressure of society on these rich folks, and then how they translate that to their kids. You know, he's Neil's supposed to be this, doctor by the time he's done. Mm-hmm. But he really wants to be an actor. He's got the acting bug, and this is something that he really wants to do. And, even though he has been encouraged by Robin Williams in the movie to go and tell his parents about it, he knows he can't talk to his dad about going to act. He knows he can't do that. And he goes and does it anyway. And there's that whole scene where Kurtwood Smith is like basically saying, you know, you're going to be a doctor, and that's that. And basically it's all in the parents' glory. It has nothing to do with the son's glory whatsoever. Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, the mom, it's hard to blame the mom because she's obviously she's probably been abused in some way too by this guy. Like, she doesn't do anything that she obviously wants what Neil wants, but she can't say anything either. Mm-hmm. She doesn't care about the status and all this, but that's how, you know, I mean, you know that there's societal pressure because Kurtwood Smith finds out about this acting is when one of his friends says, "Oh, your son Neil is in a play with one of my kids," and he's like, "Oh no, he's not in some sort of play, and you made a liar out of me, Neil." And at the very end, like towards the end, when he's busted him doing the Midsummer Night's Dream at the end and everything, and he's in the chair. And Neil finally comes up with the balls to say something like, "What about what I want?" He can't say any more than that. He has no, and Kurtwood Smith is like, "What is it? This acting business? Because you can forget about that." He's like, and that's basically that. And the mom just sits there and does nothing the whole time. I think they, and then they have the balls to, blame Neil's death on Mr. Keating in the movie. That adds even more, and it's so realistic. I mean, think about what goes on in society every day. It's such a realistic thing for people to blame others for what happened to their family members and not look inward, And yeah, they're just evil fucking monsters. The mom, probably not an evil fucking monster, but certainly just never had the, you know, didn't have the strength to fight back against her husband. And because a good question as to whether or not she should have at some point down that line figured out a way. But yeah, those guys are monsters. Yeah, there's no doubt about it.
Gotcha. I was also have a very, very realistic one. The dad in Walk Hard.
The wrong kid died.
Yeah. he goes hard, man. And no pun intended. Like, even when Dewey's on his fucking, you know, recovery trip and everything, he gets in there and he's just like, the wrong kid died.
A serious answer that I thought of while you were talking, Chris, that I want to supersede my planned answers with is Natalie Portman's family in The Professional.
Yeah, for sure.
This is at least a mom and dad. The little boy, he's harmless. He's an angel. The older sister, probably just a regular older sister. But the parents, they don't love this kid. They barely even acknowledge this kid's existence. Mm-hmm. And that apartment, the first time you go into that apartment and watch how that family interacts, it just makes you feel dirty. Not just because the apartment itself is very dirty, but because the people are dirty. Their souls have come out of Marcellus Wallace's suitcase, mm-hmm. and they are dirty souls, heavy, dirty souls, says mm-hmm. 21 Pilots. I just think that's an awful family, especially when it's juxtaposed with how ultimately easy it is for a fucking hitman to treat her with a little bit of kindness. Mm-hmm. Yeah, what else did I write down? Anything else worth saying? Oh, the family in Ready or Not.
Oh, nice one.
Yeah.
Oh, I love that my movie God. So much. Oh.
I do too, but they're so evil.
Yes.
Like, everything, I mean, even the fiance's son is evil. Why would you ever bring someone into this environment? Even if you think, well, we're just going to get tic-tac-toe this year for my fiance, you still just brought her into this family. Now she's going to be a part of future murders, even if she doesn't get murdered.
What's the deal mm-hmm. with Adam Brody in that? Is he framed as the good guy? I forget.
No, I mean, I wouldn't say he's a good guy. I just think he doesn't really care about the tradition.
Okay. And I think there's the moment near the end where he does the right thing, but I feel like it's ultimately undercut. I do feel like he tries to help her at one point.
He does. But, there's also a hint that he kind of is in love with her too. Mm-hmm. And
how could you not be?
Right. Exactly. I would frame it as more of as a generational change. Mm-hmm. You know, like that may have been a great tradition back in his dad's day, but now this doesn't seem like it flies. And he's probably like, I don't even think this, he probably even thinks, what is the point of this anymore? Like this does, are we really rich because we keep doing this every time somebody gets married in our family? You know, I get the sense that there's a lot of things going on. He's drinking during it. He's, there's a lot of different things, but so I think he's willing to go along with it. If it were anybody, you know, he wasn't attracted to, maybe he probably would just go through with it, but I don't know. I never got the sense he was a truly good person in that.
Well, he ends up with the same fate as the rest of the family.
It's true. Well, yeah.
I gotta watch that movie again. You just mm-hmm. got my emotions all wilded out. Mine is, I'll stay with alt horror and say The Family and Get Out.
mm-hmm. Oh man.
Speaking mm-hmm. of Bradley man. Whitford.
Speaking of Bradley yeah. Whitford.
Bradley Whitford, Catherine Keener, Allison Williams, and the creepy guy.
Yeah, Caleb Landry Jones.
Yeah, that guy. Mm-hmm. They are obviously evil bastards, all working on one evil bastard plan for generations. This mm-hmm. fucking family, man, and mm-hmm. and you know the commentary obviously makes it so much better of how they're essentially posing as progressive, you know, elites. And she even gives them a heads up about it. She gives she tells Daniel Kaluuya's character, she's like, he's going to tell you he would have voted for Obama for the third time if he could. And of course he does. And like, and you, And you believe at that point that he's corny as fuck, but you don't know the extent of which he's an asshole. You know he's an asshole. You kind of think Catherine Keener's character is an asshole.
Mm-hmm.
And you know Caleb Landry Johnson's a fucking asshole.
Yep. He doesn't hide it.
He does not. But that's good. I have to put in the second generation of the Corleone family in The Godfather as the biggest a-holes. Now, obviously, Michael Corleone is the biggest asshole of all time. Because, you know, he kills his brother, he kills all the heads of the five families, he kills Mo Green. He basically becomes a true psychopath. But everybody else in that movie, in that franchise, in that generation, are big old assholes, too. Sonny orders a hit on the kid that's supposed to chauffeur Vito around without knowing whether or not he actually had anything to do with the shooting. Now, he does, but he doesn't know that at the time. And Clements is like, it's done. That's it. Like, I just fucking kill that guy. That's it. And then you look at Godfather 2 and look at what Tom Hagen does with the senator and covering up that whole situation. Like, you could argue that Fredo's the best one. Fredo tried to have his brother killed. So like everybody, all that generation, you look at Connie. Connie's just a fucking basket case. Yes, a lot of it's because of trauma, but Jesus Christ, like that generation, Vito had ascended to the top of his field, you could say, by being compassionate, by looking out, by always punching up instead of down, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it seems like the second generation of Corleones are just like, fuck it, I'm going to do whatever I want to do. And yet we root for him for some reason. I can tell I got Jeremy drawn in with this Godfather conversation. But
no, it's like, I gotta be honest, I love The Godfather. I've seen the first two movies probably five or six times in my whole life each. But sometimes it's like listening to you guys talk about poker, because I don't know. I mean, outside of Corleone, you start throwing out these other names, and I don't know if it's another family head or like somebody who works for the Don, or if he's in Tony Soprano's crew.
Yeah. There's a lot of overlap there.
Yeah.
I wasn't trying to tune you out. It's not easy for me to follow, but I know the Fredo part.
Mm-hmm.
Well, when Fredo turned the flop, then he bet hard.
We had pocket aces at the time. Yeah. You got to remember that.
He brought the juice, and yeah, all right. Anyway, so that's my answer. But
then Kirsten Dunst showed up. No, trying to figure something out to get Jeremy back into the conversation.
Kristen Stewart is a
Kristen Stewart, but I'm sure Kirsten Dunst would work too. Those are definitely some holes. All of them are holes.
That's the holes. Kirsten have Dunst, been
she's married to Jesse Plemons, right?
Yep. Yes, they have a kid together too,
like just fairly recently, right?
Yeah, like in the last couple of years
they met doing Fargo.
Yeah, doing the Fargo. They were a couple in that
season two.
Yeah, I think it's season two.
Two.
I got to go back and watch that. God, that's such a good show. Anyway, good for them. What a handsome couple.
That's right. Mm-hmm. All right, everybody, it's time to talk about BetterHelp.
BetterHelp. This is good stuff, folks. I've heard this, and God bless them. BetterHelp's getting the message out, not only through us, but through other outlets. And there's a reason for it. Like, they're really putting this service out there in a time where people really need it. You know, we are still in the middle of a pandemic, no matter where in that pandemic that we're at. People are still being cautious. People are still staying more at home. Telehealth is going gangbusters because there's a big need for it. And if you think about it, man, you take an anxious person. Take a person that really has issues, in particular with social anxiety, with going places, with interacting with people, with interacting with multiple people. It could be a little challenging for this person to go into a regular therapist's office, sit down, deal with the insurance, deal with the front desk person, deal with the people in the waiting room and all that stuff, just to get to the appointment. So you can imagine that that person or people that need certain things like that would do very, very well with a counseling service that is at home, online, all taken care of, on your console, on your tablet, phone, whatever, where you just log on to your counseling room, schedule your appointments, do your appointments, whether they're video or they're chats or whatever. Everything is right there. BetterHelp has all that ready for you, and it's awesome.
I want to just give a little anecdote about my own personal journey and share a bit of progress I've had that has come directly from therapy, as well as some tips and tools that I have learned in therapy to apply in my day-to-day life. So in June, my brother's family was down visiting, and we had a good time. We always enjoy seeing them. He's got three kids. When they left, it was about 10 minutes. I turned to my wife and I said, I love them. I love seeing them. Why am I so freaking relieved when they leave? Like I'm anxious because my routine is not being followed. There are five extra people in the house. I'm anxious about the cats getting out. I have all these anxieties that show up whenever my routine is altered. But I've been learning about why that is. I've been learning about the root cause of that particular kind of my anxiety. And understanding it helps a lot. I've also learned some things to do, specifically breathing exercises, memory tricks that can help focus in a moment of anxiety. So my brother and his family were just here again this past weekend. I had the best time.
Nice.
And when they left, I was sad and I missed them. And I wasn't relieved.
I'm glad you were sad.
I had moments of anxiety when they were here, but I was able to get through them without that weighing around my neck the entire weekend. And that, I'm telling you, is huge for me. And it all came because not just therapy, but regular therapy and regular search and discovery about my own brain, my own life, and why I am the way I am. And BetterHelp can help you make that kind of progress too. And you don't even have to get out of your pajamas or leave your bedroom.
There you go. Yeah. I mean, you should probably, but you don't have to.
Depends on what time of day, whether.
Right. Sure. Should. Yeah. Yeah. It that makes sense. But I mean, these coping strategies that Jeremy was just talking about is like, you know, in a video game where you're playing as a character like Free Guy, where like he just happens upon like a medical kit and like all of a sudden he's like, yeah. I feel great.
Yeah.
you know, and when he's picking up money and stuff like that, these are skills that you actually use like items that you collect over time. And it may seem kind of cliche and rote, but no, they actually do come in really handy when you need them.
Yeah.
You know, both before as preparation for a situation in which you may think that you're going to have some adverse effects, but also in the moment, breathing exercises, focusing, being aware, that kind of thing. BetterHelp, guys, is online professional counseling. You can access it today, right this second. In fact, if you want to pause this right now, baby, by all means,
pause this
right now. Go to betterhelp.com/syncast. Get 10% off your first month. You answer some questions. You get set up with a licensed professional counselor. You're matched within 48 hours. I mean, that's less than 2 days, people. That's pretty amazing. Mm-hmm. And then you're off and running. You know, you can talk to that person. If for some reason you are having an issue, you know, breaking through or breaking ground or something like that, you can switch therapists at any time with no judgment, no cost or anything like that. BetterHelp has it all. They really have worked this out to where it's the most patient-centric or client-centric platform that I have seen in this area. So I would highly recommend it, as we all would. BetterHelp.com, HELP.com/syncast. Go ahead right now. Now, here we go. What movie provides the most interesting slash unique take on life after death? This person asked this after watching The Discovery with Jason Segel and Robert Redford. There is a trigger warning from mass talk and some depiction of suicide. I don't know.
I'm assuming there's a lot of talk about suicide is what that
means. Mass talk. Okay, gotcha. The ideas presented in the movie are not something I had ever heard. I hope you're doing well. I've actually never heard of The Discovery. Have you guys?
No.
Yes, but it went out of my brain. So this is like me rediscovering The Discovery.
Does it have, did you see the letters Disker or whatever and have to like wipe it off to figure it out? The Discovery.
Nice. VJ.
I haven't seen The Seventh Seal in forever, but a lot of the things that we take, you know, that movie has the, you know, the main character playing chess with the Grim Reaper, and that's what they did in Bill and Ted's Bogus Journey. And
what?
Yeah, right. Exactly. You know, it's I think it's set during the Black Plague, and it's Ingmar Bergman, who was always a cheerful director. you know, it's an exploration of life after death, and you know, it's there's very few movies that have matched its style and its and everything, but I haven't seen it in forever. So maybe it's antiquated today as far as its uniqueness, but I don't know. Can anything ever not become unique once it was unique back in 1957? Does it become not unique if people have done those type of things since?
I don't know, man. There's so many different takes that you could make on the afterlife, including Bill and Ted's Bogus Journey. You
can throw that in. It's very true. Yeah. I mean, there were thoughts of also like stuff like The Sixth Sense that's not the whole idea that the character that you're talking to is dead the whole time wasn't brand new. I hate to break that to everybody, but, you know, that one came to mind, but I felt like the Seventh Seal is one that, it's should be discussed in the life after death.
Yeah. Again, into that.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting.
I don't think
I've ever seen that movie.
It's only an hour and a half, by the way. It sounds like something that'll be 3.5 hours long, like The Seventh Seal, Max von Sydow, young Max von Sydow, is in that one, but, yeah, I need to watch it again myself.
So meaning he was like 65.
He was 65.
Yeah.
Who was the guy that's like was it Franklin Langella?
Oh yeah,
was it Franklin Langella. Yeah. He's like I like him, but I've never seen him when he's not old.
either one of you guys ever see Defending Your Life?
Yeah, Albert Brooks.
Albert Brooks and Meryl Streep,
yeah.
Rip Torn.
I don't think I have. And I've seen a lot of Albert Brooks movies, but I think I've missed that one.
I've had two different times in my life where I've gone on Albert Brooks binges and watched all of his movies. And
Modern Romance.
I've also surprisingly gone on James L. Brooks binges.
Right.
and there's some overlap there. anyway, Albert Brooks wrote and directed Defending Your Life, and he plays the main character. Goes to heaven and basically is put on trial. Now, you have to swallow the conceit we all hate that human beings only use a certain percentage of their brain. In this movie, it's like less than 5.
Well, at least it's not a basis to give the other person superpowers afterwards.
Right, right. Mm-hmm. So they basically joke that, you know, on Earth, you only use 3 or 5% of your brain because you're so overcome by your fears. And so the trial is to determine if he's still afraid and has to go back to Earth and get reincarnate and try and conquer his fears in another life, or if he has conquered enough fears to use more than 5% of his brain, in which case he'll be allowed to move on to the next phase of existence because his higher brain power will be able to enjoy more of the universe. And it's in this little village full of people who are all in the phases of being on trial, he meets Meryl Streep, and they fall in love. Mm-hmm. And basically, it's very Albert Brooksy. It's talky, it's high concept, it's funny, and I'm not going to spoil it, even though it's a 30-year-old movie. But it's an interesting way because to look at the afterlife, because when he's on trial, they keep showing video clips of his life, where in moments where he was afraid, where he had fears. Yeah, I like it. It's a nice little gem that I would never have watched had I not started with broadcast news and said, I want to watch everything that guy does. Mm-hmm. He's awesome.
Yeah, I need to see that. I've seen Modern Romance like multiple times. What's the other one that I've seen that's got Julie Haggerty in it?
I've just watched that one a week ago.
Isn't it a cross country trip or something
with an RV? Yeah, it's because he quits his
Lost
job.
Lost in America.
Yes, I think that's it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Modern Romance has that great, because he plays a sound gaffer guy in Modern Romance, and like there's a scene where they're doing this science fiction film and the guy's running across a spaceship floor and they're trying to come up with the footstep sounds and everything, and they're like looking for old audio because they don't have anything. They can't figure out how to get the steps to match or whatever. And so they're like looking for old audio, and they get this one that's like Hulk running or something like that is what it's called. The file they have, Hulk running. And like they put the Hulk running over this guy running through the spaceship, and it's like, oh, and Albert Brooks is like, he's like, that's not Hulk running. That's Hulk screaming. That's what that should say.
Wow. I love this question. And of our generation, of my generation, I guess, the first thing that came to my mind was What Dreams May Come.
Yeah.
I kind of want to go back and revisit that because I do remember it being, of course, visually beautiful, but also that's a bad movie. It's rather
lame. You know what? I was surprised. That movie got terrible reviews when it came out. I remember watching it and not liking it, but I think it's got a 7.2 or something on the IMDb these days.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. Well, that's why I kind of want to go back and give it another shot just to see if it's as bad as I thought it was. But my real things are one irreverent thing, Beetlejuice, man. Beetlejuice is so great when Alec Baldwin and Gina Davis just realize they're dead and they're trying to spook the new people out of their house. It's fucking hilarious, man. It's such a great take on the afterlife and what you would do to kind of get your old life back or to settle into what the afterlife is going to look like. You have to recruit the services of this. What is his title? The ghost with the most, but like anti-exorcist or something like that. He's a human exorcist. Keaton's character, and Michael Keaton, I think people now, I think they probably know him as more of a serious actor. Even Batman, he's kind of more of his serious stuff. Especially Birdman, especially Spotlight, you know, stuff like that. And people forget that he was every bit as big of a comic actor as somebody like Jim Carrey or Ryan Reynolds or anything like that.
He had a career like Tom Hanks, was in a bunch of comedies and then started doing a little drama there and never really quite got to the Oscar nominee level that Tom Hanks did every year, but started kind of like the same way.
Yeah. And actually, I wonder, I don't know this, I should know this off the top of my head, but was he nominated for Birdman? I believe he was.
Yeah,
it would be a shame if he weren't.
He lost, but I can't remember who won.
But yeah, even with Spotlight obviously won, but he wasn't. I don't even know if he was nominated for that because it's such an ensemble piece.
Think so. He's only been nominated once, and it was for Birdman.
Wow. Mm-hmm. And yeah, you're right. It's definitely moving in that direction. But he was such a great comic actor, especially. You know, you go back and watch Beetlejuice, you'll be absolutely smiling ear to ear.
Oh, yeah.
Winona Ryder is great in that. Alec Baldwin and Gina Davis are great as that couple, by the way. Catherine O'Hara, the whole thing is just so much fun.
Yeah.
I would be remiss to not mention Coco. Coco.
Coco!
I would take over Soul. I know a lot of people like Soul as one of the most emotionally resonant pictures of the afterlife. I am not ashamed to admit that I bawled like an absolute baby at the end of Coco, during the Remember Me song. It is, It is gut-wrenching. The Edward James Olmos character, Chicharron in the afterlife.
Yeah.
Even the pain behind the eyes of Gael Garcia Bernal, his character in the afterlife. The Abuela, like, God damn, this movie is absolutely aces. Oh, no, is this Disney or Pixar? I know there's the same thing, but
it's Pixar.
But yeah, it's Pixar on that side of things.
Yeah,
it is up there. I think every bit as good as Inside Out to me. Every bit as good as like the top tier Pixar movies. Yeah, it's so great visually, musically, acting wise.
Looks like you got some pain behind those eyes.
You got some pain behind those skeleton eyes. And the bridge going over to the Land of the Dead is one of the most visually spectacular things. I had to like just pause it the first time I watched it because I was like, holy fuck, that's amazing.
Yeah.
So yeah, watch Coco if you haven't watched Coco. You probably watch Coco, but if not, watch Coco.
Coco.
Mm-hmm.
This will be a fun one. Hey, I don't know why I'm talking like this. This will be a fun one. What song has been indelibly linked to a movie? I heard a commercial with Edith Piaf singing Je ne regrette rien and immediately thought about Inception, of course, or that song to be tied to the Penguins of Madagascar, of course. Yes,
right.
I have seen the Penguins of Madagascar and I know what he's talking about.
It's interesting. I think friends of mine like Mike and Barrett had probably heard, I know had heard Where Is My Mind by the Pixies before Fight Club. I had not. Somehow I had completely missed that song up until the point Fight Club came out. I don't know if it's because of that, but that song is always going to be tied to Fight Club to me. The very end of that and all the buildings exploding and Edward Norton and Helena Bonham Carter having their moment. At the end, I can't think of a better. I mean, that song is so perfect for that thing. Even though Barrett mentioned a long time ago what that song was really about. It's like him chasing a chicken around or something.
No, he's swimming in the Caribbean and he sees a fish and he starts thinking about how the fish is what the fish is experiencing. But
I had nothing to do with the chicken then.
No, but I was well versed in that song, as you mentioned. I got Surfer Rosa back in the day, probably because it has an exposed breast on the cover. But as soon as I hear that, that's the first thing that I think. I've got a question for you, though.
Yeah.
What happens to Tyler / Edward Norton's character after that? Does he die? What happens at the end of Fight Club, do you think?
He's going to have some pretty hefty medical bills if he doesn't die.
Yeah. I think the movie is saying that the Tyler part of him is gone.
Yes.
Because he figures it out and he takes a stand against that character at the end. A lot of people speculated that the building they're in is supposed to blow up, but they disarmed the bomb, I believe, in the building that they're in.
Yeah.
So a lot of people have speculated, well, they're in a building that's going to blow up. Well, no, it doesn't blow up because they disconnected it. Do you see the couple living happily ever after that?
Because he does blow the Brad Pitt character out of his head. But I think at that point, doesn't he become Tyler Durden, right? He still has the ideas. Like, he's watching the world burn.
But he thinks what Tyler's done is horrifying. That's why he goes on all those trips to make sure what's going on.
I think they're just watching the spectacle, like it's a fireworks show or something. It's too late to turn it back now.
He may be the quiet, meek shopper or whatever, back to the regular Edward Norton that we know. But he's just at that point, it's an inevitability, and he's just going to watch it for the time.
Yeah, I think it's, you know, I mean, that's the end of his personal journey. And of course, it ends with a bunch of insurance and bank buildings getting exploded at the end. It's sort of like, what can you do at that point? Right.
Yeah.
What's done is done. I also put in Sexy Boy by Air, which is in 10 Things I Hate About You, when they throw the invitations to the party in the stairwell. And it's like, and it's such a great fucking song.
It is. And
it goes along with that, you know, that scene so well, because there's something poetic about all those invitations falling through the stairwell like they do in that movie. Also, Jump Into the Fire by Harry Nilsson in the Goodfellas helicopter scene is always going to be almost any song, by the way, in Goodfellas is married to Goodfellas. Atlantis by Donovan is another one when they're beating down. What's his name?
Billy Batts.
When they're beating down Billy Batts and that way down below the ocean. I've wondered for a long time why he picked that song, but it goes along with that scene so well.
And Layla, I mean, Layla was a huge hit before and afterwards. But you know, Layla's had such a weird arc because it's a Derek and the Dominoes song, even though Eric Clapton played on it. It is Derek and the Dominoes. And then it's got the big piano part at the end of it that's so associated with Goodfellas. And then Clapton did it again for his Unplugged thing, where it became, I think, maybe even charted higher than the original Derek and the Dominoes thing. By the way, Eric Clapton, not my favorite person right now, but that Unplugged performance of Layla is fucking rad.
Oh, yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah, that's true. It is a good one.
I have a few, but the first one I want to talk about is not only associated indelibly with a movie, but now with the studio logo. So like when the Universal logo comes up on my TV and I don't know what's coming on, if I just happen to have been on a movie channel and you hear that, and it finishes their music, I always hear Love You Madly by Cake, because that's Forgetting Sarah Marshall, and I've seen that movie a thousand times. So sometimes just the Universal logo makes me start humming, I want to love you madly.
It's interesting, just to break in, that Universal logo thing, it's every time that comes up, I think of the first time they used it, which was on Lost World Jurassic Park.
Because
I remember them, that Universal logo was always that plain, you know, world picture with Universal going across it. And then when they did Lost World Jurassic Park, that's when they started doing that. So anyway.
I also will put down Son of a Preacher Man, Pulp Fiction. We Are Family. And at the end of The Birdcage.
Always think of The Birdcage when that song plays. I
always do, because there's this moment where Robin Williams walks by Gene Hackman in drag and encourages him, you know, lip sync, you know, get into it. And Gene Hackman's like, we are family. You can see him mouthing the words. I fucking love that movie. I think that is a top 10 comedy of all time. I've been mulling lately a list of what I think would be the top 10 comedy movies of all time, and The Birdcage would be on it.
Fascinating. So you're going to take, and I think I agree with you. You think of all the songs in Pulp Fiction, Son of a Preacher Man is the one that's really...
To be honest, any song from that soundtrack, if I hear it on the radio, makes me think of that movie.
Yeah.
Any song. But Son of a Preacher Man, mostly. It's the strongest of all those. But Tarantino has this great way of finding music that people can rediscover, like, or were never number one hits, but so like even in Kill Bill with that Tarantino's movies are all full of songs like that, where you're like, oh, I remember this, but now I'm only going to associate it with this movie because it's actually more famous now than before the movie.
Like in Death Proof, the lap dance scene with Vanessa Ferlito, that honky tonk in Mexico song is just burned into my brain because of
that in Mexico. Yeah, that's good stuff. Or After Dark, the Salma Hayek strip tease scene Till Dawn.
Yeah,
even though I just wrote that. I actually picked a Tarantino movie too, but I'll eschew that. But it's weird. I've been a David Bowie fan for a long time, but I don't think I can listen to Starman anymore and not think about that thing. A montage we'll talk about later on, but that whole sequence in The Martian, it's so perfect. The sound, I was talking to my son about this last night, about how he doesn't like musicals because he feels like they're mixed wrong. Like you should have a proper mix, which is, by the way, blew my mind how brilliant this kid is. But like, I think the sound, the mix in that Starman sequence is perfect because the transfer is so crisp of that song, of the track. And then it can hear all the other stuff that's going on because there's a lot of shit going on. That's when the Ares is turning around, right? Or plotting their whole thing where they're boomeranging around.
Slingshot around Earth, yeah.
Yeah. And then Mark is getting ready on his side and all that shit. And all the NASA and the JPL stuff is going on. And the Chinese are getting... That sequence is just kind of ingrained into me now. Even though I like the Pixies. Like, I had heard Starman a billion times before I saw that, but... It did a great job with that. And gonna find my baby, gonna hold her tight, gonna grab some afternoon delight.
Yeah. Which one?
Well, I think it's Anchorman. I think it has to be Anchorman because.
Okay. For me, it's Good Will Hunting.
But, I agree. That's right up there. And that's the first time. In fact, that's the first time I ever heard reference to afternoon delight because it's like, you know. We can make a lot of loving before the sun goes down. I think, come on, Doc. Skyrockets and flooded afternoon delight.
You really hypnotized me, though.
Really hypnotized. I don't need therapy. But yeah, no, I think because Matt Damon or Will Hunting sings it so badly in that movie that I didn't think.
Yeah.
Then when you have Anchorman and everybody's just like casually joining in with like all the harmonies.
I'm telling you, it's that moment, the moment that makes, that's a funny scene no matter what, but the moment that makes it perfect is when they do that perfect harmonized skyrockets in flight and one of them goes,
yeah, it's champ. It's champ. Well, he goes boo, and then he goes, and then they talk about it. They go, oh, that's, I think that's kind of lame, Ron. Yeah, that's lame, Ron. And then he's like, afternoon delight. And they just cut it off. And they're like, oh, okay, I got some stuff to do. And they all go back to their things. Oh, it's so great.
That just that little whatever that is, slide whistle thing that you're talking about, where reminded me of the scene in Inside Llewyn Davis where Adam Driver is the guy who's like saying all the things during the song. So they're like, they get done with the song and he sits there and he's like practicing while they're having a conversation. He keeps saying, shoot,
shoot,
outer space.
Uh-oh. Please, Mr. Kennedy. Uh-oh. All right, here's a fun one. Here's the next one. What if Detective Comics, also known as DC Comics, what if DC had started off their universe with Shazam and the Suicide Squad? Both movies were tons of fun and were about the characters in them rather than the movies they were trying to set up for later. Universe building rather than universe dependent. Ooh, it's a loaded question, folks.
It is. I say I understand this question. Where they're going with this. What if they made good movies instead of bad ones? But if they couldn't start off with Shazam or the Suicide Squad, right?
Correct.
Neither of those movies on their own without an attached universe with known characters, would those movies do anything? I think, I guess you could say we're going to start with Shazam and say this is the beginning of the DCEU and we're going to come out with Batman and Superman and Wonder Woman later. But most people are like, who the fuck is Shazam? Or is that Shaquille O'Neal character? And so I don't think they could have come out with movies like that. There's a reason why Marvel didn't come out with Guardians of the Galaxy first, right?
Right.
And that property, they didn't even think that was going to do anything even after all the Marvel stuff was popular.
Yeah.
And they stuck it in August thinking, okay, we'll see what happens. And then it became a huge hit. So, but they wouldn't have started with that. They wouldn't have been like, here's Guardians of the Galaxy and then we'll do Iron Man after that. But yeah,
I've got a question for you, Chris. Do you think it was Marvel Studios that had Iron Man, right? It was their first movie, or was that
was the one that kicked it off? Yes.
No, I know, but
Hulk came first.
Well, Hulk, I mean the MCU, as you're talking about it, Iron Man came first. Incredible Hulk came out.
Yeah. So was it Marvel Studios that put that out, though, or it wasn't Disney, obviously, yet.
It was Marvel with Paramount that came out with Iron Man, and it was Marvel with Universal that came out with Incredible Hulk, because Universal still owns the rights to Hulk. Then Paramount, I don't know what deal this was. I wasn't paying attention at the time that it happened. Paramount, which owned Iron Man, Captain America, and Thor, all those movies are Paramount. Somehow, some way, Paramount, either they had the one chance to make their movie and they had to sell it to Marvel later or sell it to Disney later. I don't know how that worked, but eventually it became a whole unified thing, except for the Hulk. They had to still pay Universal their money for that. They unified all those characters under the Disney Marvel banner.
Right. Do you think they had expectations for Iron Man? Because as we've talked about before, Iron Man was kind of, now I don't know about the comics, maybe he's a huge person in the comics, but to the general public, I don't think a lot of people knew a lot about Iron Man. We've already talked about, you know, the gamble with Robert Downey Jr. and fucking John Favreau at this point in 2008. Do you feel like they did have, whether it was Paramount or whether it was Marvel, or whether it was both of them together, do you think they had, obviously no one could have predicted what it became, but like, do you think they had pretty high expectations for that whole like story?
That's a good question. Actually, it's a good question, because I think they did a poll before that movie came out. Like, how many of you know what Iron Man is?
Hmm.
And you know, most of the public did not know who Iron Man was at all.
I mean, I knew just very peripherally, and you know,
at the same time, they did have the stinger at the end with Sam Jackson and the Stingers, you know, the Avengers Initiative and everything at the end. And they even put in, you know, is it Downey at the end of Incredible Hulk, or is it?
Yeah. Because it's Jackson.
So they had,
They
had to have had some inkling that it was going to be, maybe they knew what they had as a movie when they made it.
Mm.
Like, not many people know who this is, but we're going to make them know who it is.
And they did.
Yeah. And I don't know who else they could have. I mean, Captain America, I suppose, could have launched that whole thing, because more people know who Captain America is. They didn't have the rights to Spider-Man.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and so it, I don't know. It may have been, it's a good question. And actually, you know, from what I just said about DC not starting off with Shazam or something like that, maybe there was a legitimate way to start off with Shazam and then just say, Batman and Superman are coming. We just want to do this one first.
It's almost, I mean, if they had followed that, and especially with the movies that ended up with Shazam and Guardians, or not Guardians of the Galaxy, Suicide Squad. And I think Jeremy and I had suggested throwing in Birds of Prey too, because that's such a fun movie, the antithesis of everything. I think if you had started out like that and you had started out with something like Iron Man, right? Like a substantial character, but maybe not one that everybody knows, that would have been, you know, more of the reverse, like engineering thing to build up to. Man of Steel was the first DCEU official movie, right?
Yes. Okay. In the end, though, what their real problem was not that they didn't come out with something like Shazam first. The problem is that they saw what the Avengers did and they said, I want to do that now.
Yes. And, I don't want to wait.
And they could have cleaned up by getting a Kevin Feige type to come in and be like, let's make Superman, and shit, we can make it dour, but let's make it good. Let's not make it a slog. Mm-hmm. And you know, just had a plan for all the movies before they came out. 'Cause now you can see what Warner Brothers is doing with all these properties. Now they're just like, whatever comes to our head, we're just sticking it out there.
Absolutely. Joker's in its own universe. Batman's in his own other
universe. They even got, to a certain degree, they got what they wanted. They gave this universe to Snyder, and he made Man of Steel, Batman v Superman, and Justice League. Batman v Superman was a massive box office hit. Now, it didn't make as much as they wanted, but that made a shit ton of movie. But that wasn't enough for them, because they wanted the praise that the MCU was getting, too. And honestly, my whole take to this whole question is, I lost my train of thought. I have a take. It's going to come back into my brain, but I lost it on my little rant-a-do there.
It made a shit ton of money. You said movie, but that's totally fine.
Thank
you. It is a shit ton of movie.
I think it should make a. It made a shit ton of movie as well.
Well, yes, it has.
It's very long. It's very long.
But. I can't find it. Somebody talk. I'll interject.
I think the main problem is kind of going back to how Marvel did things, and you have to compare the two. You have to. But not only did Marvel start off with kind of a tertiary character or like a less famous character, they also took a chance on Jon Favreau, who's obviously a very competent, if not very good director, but mm-hmm. didn't what he had made. He had directed a few.
Well, Zathura, and he had done Cowboys versus Elf. Aliens.
Oh, and Elf. Yeah, for sure. Yeah. So, but he was by far.
Had he done Cowboys versus Aliens at that point? I don't know. He had about four movies, I think, under his belt by the time he does Iron Man, which there may be a question as to whether they thought it would be this big. By starting it off this way, Robert Downey Jr. is your main character, John Favreau directing. And then they put in that Avengers stinger in there, but they may have not expected it to be that good.
No, but I mean, what they did have success with, and what DC has had success with, is hiring Kathy Yan and hiring James Gunn and hiring David Sandberg to do things that are not Snyder-y.
And that's my point. That's what I just remembered was my point. Would we even, it's not really fair to compare, because I don't believe we would have gotten Shazam, Birds of Prey, whatever the good ones are that we're getting today. I think the only reason we got those was because there was so much failure beforehand and they were forced to take risks. They were forced to say, well, we haven't tried fun. Let's try fun.
We haven't tried Matt Reeves doing something completely different. Yeah,
you can't go back to 2008, 2012, whenever the fuck, and say, well, if they'd made different characters into films, it would have made a difference to the cinematic universe, because the thinking at DC back then was still dark, serious, muted colors. That's exactly why Snyder got the job. It's exactly why they gave Nolan executive producer from his trilogy to this new universe. They wanted what they already had. They got it, and the public got tired of it. Now they started taking risks, and they're having success, but they would never have made the Suicide Squad the way James Gunn made it 12 years ago.
Oh, fuck never. No. Fuck no. Absolutely not.
They wouldn't have taken that risk.
No, definitely not. I mean, I think they would have made something like Shazam. And was Birds of Prey R, or was that PG-13?
I believe it was R.
That was R because, you had Ewan McGregor doing all kinds of, like,
it was pretty violent but sweary.
Yeah, exactly. And, I mean, the deal with Shazam is that it was family-friendly, and it was a good story, and it was an origin type of thing that did have direct parallels with Superman and stuff like that. I personally would love to have Superman hidden as he is in Shazam, and then we go into his story, into a Man of Steel type of thing or something like that later on, rather than here's Superman, the most powerful person in this universe. Oh, and here's the other characters.
Yeah. I mean, they needed the same kind of 6-year plan, or was it, how long was it? 6 years? It was, Iron Man came out in 2008.
Yeah, and 12 was Avengers, right?
Yeah, so I guess they got that done in 4 years, but they needed a plan where they came out with origin stories and well-made origin stories to get you familiar with those characters. And this, the DCEU, we're doing Man of Steel, and then it's like Batman v Superman is their second thing.
Yeah, yeah. We're going to have them
tearing into each other because of the events of Man of Steel. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I mean, and then you start like throwing characters in just as Wonder Woman shows up in Batman v Superman. And mm-hmm. it's like, can we not go ahead and get like kind of an introduction to these characters before they show up?
And look at Wonder Woman. In fact, in your email, Jeremy, you mentioned that Wonder Woman should be thrown into that good DC.
Well, that's the other point I wanted to make, is that I think we're exaggerating how bad the DCEU is. Like, Man of Steel's not great, but it's not Batman v Superman bad. First Wonder Woman's good. Second Wonder Woman's bad.
Oh, it's so bad.
But we talk about the DCEU as though they've only had one or two good movies, but especially at this point, that's just not the case anymore.
It's the Snyder influence. And again, you know, the guy's a talented filmmaker. He's got a lot of elan, apparently. Like in And apparently, like,
ennui.
He's called Orphan. But his movies are the worst ones of the whole batch. Patty Jenkins did a great job. James Wan did a great job with what he had, or he did a good job with Aquaman. Something ain't working, and it's probably Zack Snyder. I'm just going to whisper.
Maybe. Maybe.
I'm going to jump down a little bit. I like this a lot. Best performance in a movie or TV show from a person more known from another medium, such as a musician, author, something else, etc. What do you think?
Sean Combs in Get Him to the Greek. You know him as Puff Daddy or P. Diddy or... Couple of other names, yeah. But his character in Get Him to the Greek is hilarious.
I don't know where it came from. Like, I'm sure the guy is talented, and I'm sure he's funny. Like, mm-hmm. but he's hilarious.
He's also in the movie Made, by the way. Made getting a second reference.
It's a movie that more people should watch. It's a really good movie.
Yeah, it's really good. And here's another person who may be known more as an actor these days, but Ice Cube. I picked 21 Jump Street as my Ice Cube, but he's great in all other things like Boys in the Hood and Trespass.
Friday.
Definitely, you know, surprising. Like, because I think when you watched him in Boys in the Hood, you're like, ah, he's just playing himself or something like that. But ever since then, he's shown that he can play dramas like Anaconda. Straight serious movie like Anaconda.
He could do Barbershop and fucking Barbershop, Friday, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't think his performance in Friday is the best part of Friday. he's there, but Friday's an enjoyable movie.
He's usually there to be sort of a sounding board for the other comedians that are in there, but he can be funny himself. I love 21 Jump Street, man. He's like, you're gonna have to accept this or suck a dick, you know. So
like, well, the funniest part is like, infiltrate the school, find the dealer. And then like Jonah Hill and Channing Tatum are talking about something completely different. And he just looks at him for a second. And he's like, infiltrate the school, find the dealer. By the way, Channing Tatum turned out to be one of my favorite parts of Free Guy that I was not expecting.
Oh, yeah.
That whole sequence where he's Magic Miking as their old leaving mm-hmm. man. That's fucking good. Mm-hmm. I love Free Guy. Yeah. Free Guy's fucking good.
I loved it too. I'm so glad you liked it. I did not read the question correctly, especially the part where it said bad movies. So two of my answers are now thrown out. I'll give you one of the listed, and I'll give you another one.
Well, hold on. No. This doesn't say bad movies.
He starts off by saying bad movies, but I think the question is just in general, somebody who's known for something else is good in a movie, right? It starts off by saying that. You think that it's going to be about that.
Okay.
So what I saw was best performance in a movie or TV show from a person more known from another medium.
Right. He starts the whole question off, though, by saying, I see, doesn't he? He says something to the effect.
Not in this one, but it's very similar to another one that.
Oh, there's another question. Yeah, yeah, there's another question. Yeah,
yeah.
Okay.
Oh, which one?
So this is not in a bad movie. This is just a.
Oh, I was reading the wrong question. Reading the wrong question. Okay. Phew. Oh my God.
I did jump down a little bit, yes.
Then I'm going to go with Zendaya in Euphoria.
Mm-hmm.
I knew her as an actress in the Spider-Man movie, but I knew her more as a model, and I think she was a Disney kid. I think she had done some singing on Disney shows.
Yeah.
So that's a powerhouse performance. I suspect she's actually a 70-year-old. In a 20-something-year-old body, because you shouldn't be that good that young. And again, the other one that I've talked about to death is Sydney Flanagan from Never Rarely, Sometimes Always.
Yes.
She's a Canadian singer-songwriter who had never acted before in her life, and again, somehow harnessed raw, pure emotion in a way that only seasoned actors usually do. I thought I was going crazy answering the wrong question, man.
Did you ever see Malcolm and Marie with
no, not yet, but it is on the list because she's great, and that's also the same guy, right?
Same director.
Yeah.
That movie has stayed with me. I've only seen it once. And it's not, I mean, it's very much like Marriage Story in the fact that
imagine watching those movies back to back.
God, you'd either be hugging your spouse or like hugging just random people on
pillows.
So I know that you said you weren't interested in the Marriage Story show, not Marriage Story, the
Scenes from a Marriage
show. But I did read recently, apparently Oscar Isaac goes full frontal in that show.
Really?
Anecdotally, he did not realize, like, he knew he was naked, but he thought that his stuff was going to be so in shadow because it was a dark scene. Mm-hmm. And so he's watching on the playback later and he's like, oh, hey, there I am.
Yeah, that's my dick. It's so funny.
I recognize that.
The movie Wild Things has that frontal scene for Kevin Bacon in it.
Oh, yeah.
And I think he didn't realize it either. And the movie came out and everything. And you know, he sort of shrugged his shoulders. But also, if he had sued, he would be suing himself because he was a producer on the film.
Awesome. You played yourself.
Mm. Yep, exactly.
Congratulations. The only person ever to defeat himself in court.
Yep.
Your Honor.
Your Honor, this is wrong. Kevin Bacon, the producer, knew what he was doing when he published this movie.
I want to shout out Bo Burnham. You guys, nice. I think, were more familiar with Bo Burnham than I was as a YouTuber, right?
Mm-hmm.
His early YouTube stuff was basically like kind of comedic, vloggy. I don't even know.
I knew him from a special that I saw. And there were people who were younger than me who brought up Bo Burnham to me, and I saw his first, I think, Netflix special where he does all this different stuff on stage, and it's very unique. That's the only time I had ever seen him. So I was not familiar with any of the other stuff that he did before that.
Yeah. I mean, but primarily known for a brand of stand-up comedy / YouTube. And so when I heard about that, he was directing Eighth Grade, I was like, you know, I don't know much about the guy. And it turns out, That movie is spectacularly directed. You can honestly say that. You know, from the whole shot of the girl going through to the pool party to the pool, very much like Booksmart, right, where they go under the water and back up and all that stuff. It's a terrifically directed movie. And then he comes out and he plays a very complicated character in Promising Young Woman.
Yep.
And he disappears into that role. It does not look to me or seem like Bo Burnham in that role. It seems like a dude that's in medical school or he's a doctor now. Yeah. He was in medical school with Carey Mulligan's character. And he seems like that character. And he seems very endearing and finally breaks through to this character and then has one of the most gut-wrenching scenes I've seen in a long time. That entire film is gut-wrenching. Jeremy, did you ever see it? I know I keep asking you this stuff, but yeah, he's spectacular in just about everything. And of course that inside special of him doing music and directing and acting.
Still haven't finished that.
Oh my God. It's so good. I actually would love to watch it again.
Wait, no. Did you ask if I'd seen Eighth Grade?
Promising Young Woman.
No. No, I actually started Promising Young Woman twice and could not get into it.
Hmm. Another Adam Brody Scuzzball performance.
Well, it came, right. I mean, usually on Saturdays, HBO has a new movie. It drops at 7 or 8 o'clock. Mm-hmm. And I usually check every week to see what it's going to be, to see if it's something like Freaky. When I saw it was Freaky, I was like, I knew I want to watch that one. And so Promising Young Woman was the one a couple Saturdays ago. And I was like, all right. And it was a little slow for me in the early going. I'll get back to it one day.
That's interesting. I mean, yeah, your reaction is your reaction, but I thought that movie started off very interestingly, especially when Christopher Mintz-Plasse comes into the proceedings. Anyway, and then what do I want to go with? Jameela Jamil. I don't know if you guys have watched The Good Place. I have not finished The Good Place, but I saw the first three seasons or so, and she plays Tahani, this wonderful this character in this afterlife universe. By the way, that could be an answer for the best life
could.
After death thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I was surprised to know, because she is so fucking good, especially playing off of Kristen Bell. She is so good in this that she, I don't think, had seriously acted before. She was a DJ. She was a model. Obviously, she's like 6'9" or something like that and gorgeous. She's also an activist now that has a prominent role in especially like weight shaming and body shaming and stuff like that. But yeah, she apparently had not done any serious acting before that. And she's spectacular. That's a Michael Schur joint. Michael Schur is on fire. Ever since his, I guess, The Office was one of his first.
Well, yeah, and then I believe he was the chief creator of Parks and Recreation. Yeah. Of course, he was also, for a lot of you sports fans out there, he was a part of that, what was the Fire Joe Morgan website.
I didn't know that. Was he really?
He's one of the writers on Fire Joe Morgan.
No shit. Wow. Guy, he's got a good pedigree. And Michael Schur.
He does. And he's if you want to know a visual, he was Dwight's cousin or whatever on The Office.
Yeah. It's so good.
But we finally got to some Discord questions. This was a whole episode dedicated to it.
Yeah.
And I feel right. That's right. That's going to do it for this episode. Keep going to Sincast presented by CinemaSins on Facebook. We're also on CinemaSins Twitter, Music Video Sins Twitter, Discord, and SoundCloud. That's going to do it for this episode. It's Chris Atkins and Jeremy Scott and Barrett Scherer. We'll see you next time.
Thanks for listening. Comment on our episodes on our SoundCloud page. Check us out on YouTube, Twitter, Facebook, and Reddit. And be sure to visit CinemaSins.com.
I just had a conversation with my wife where I told her she needed to give off more of a bitchy vibe.
Because
old guys keep talking to her and telling their life stories to her, and she's too nice.
Is this the neighbor?
No, this is at the gym or the supermarket. I just said, you're too nice. You need to get. You need to work on your bitch face.
Yeah.
Or work on your I have things to do face.
Yeah, yeah. Or your practice nut kicks.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Exactly. I've found if you kick a guy in the nuts, pretty much no matter who he is, he's going to stop talking, at least for mm-hmm. a little bit.
You know, mm-hmm. that's a good PSA to get out there.
I knew the light wasn't supposed to fall.
Yeah, we had a Birdman moment, Jeremy.
Oh no.
I knew the light wasn't supposed to fall because it had nothing to do with anything.
Right, exactly.
And then goes over and picks it up and gives it to the guy who is playing the confectionery guy or whatever. and they put it away and everything. And I was like, there's no fucking way that's on purpose because that would have been a topic of conversation or would have factored in.
Hey, remember when that light fell down over there?
Right.
Well, it sounds like they handled it really smoothly then.
Oh, they did.
Well, they did, but they had to stop it because there was glass on the stage. So there was a moment that I think when they realized people were going to start walking around, they were like, actors, hold. We're going to get something done on the stage real quick, and we'll be back.
What's interesting to me is that at one point the skating girl falls right around that location.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? When they pull her and she fell right there. I have a feeling that was probably the real factor. They were like, mm-hmm. oh, we can't have fucking shards of glass.
When you said pauses, remember when I warned that Michael Keaton, Robert Downey Jr. movie where...
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Robert Downey Jr. is a critic and Michael Keaton is the playwright. Yeah, game six. So the actor, if in the play, I told you it had a brain like
parasite.
Yes. Mm-hmm. It was causing him to forget all his lines. And so there was this one specific line where they were supposed to say something like, this might be it. And he's supposed to say, this might be it. And in the actual performance, he can't remember the line. And there's like a 15-second pause, and then he finally says it. And later on, Robert Downey Jr. is praising the play, and he was like, that pause. That pause. It was everything. It was everything. And it was all coincidental.
In Living in Oblivion, there's one of my favorite parts of that movie is this thing that, you know, Catherine Keener and the woman playing the mother have that scene where basically Catherine Keener's talking about how her dad was awful to her and all that. And the mom's like, I have no memory of this whatsoever, is what she keeps saying.
Yeah.
And then it comes time to actually like film it or whatever. And I think it's one of the many different things that happens. There's always something that happens during the filming of it that they keep on having to break. And finally, like on the fourth or fifth time, Catherine Keener goes through this whole thing and the woman's just like sitting there, like doesn't remember the line. And you can see the people in the back and there's some crew who are like, I have no memory of this line.
Oh God, that movie's so brilliant. They've got that.
It really is.
Earlier in that, I think it was earlier in it. No, I think it's after that she absolutely fucking kills that.
It's when they don't have the cameras on.
They don't have the cameras on. So Buscemi has
to do. And this is all the segment that Steve Buscemi's dream in it, because he's dreaming that all of this is happening. And so like at the very end, they pull out the biggest knockout performance there is, and they don't even have the cameras rolling. And then finally they're like, he's like, do exactly what you just did on this last thing on camera. And then something else fucks it up, like a watch beeping or something like that. And they were like, they're like, oh yeah. And then he starts yelling at everybody about what they're doing wrong. And then they're like, and then what about you, Mabel? Oh yeah. Oh, the cameras are off now. I'll be good.
Was it Chris Moneymaker that had that thing in the World Series main event where they thought he was pausing to read somebody, but he was actually, he didn't know the action was on him?
Yeah. Yeah. It had folded around to him, and he and this other guy were just sort of staring each other down. And then and someone goes, "You realize it's on you, right?" And he goes, "Oh no, man! I thought I'd already folded." Yeah.
It wasn't Norman Chad, but it was somebody who was like, "Look at the concentration on the
yeah, which is even funnier because you know they do that after the fact. They
right,
do that
exactly. God, well, you probably did watch this. I tried my hand when they. It was a few years ago when they tried to do it live, like on TV, the ESPN broadcast live, mm-hmm. and it, like the whole cams weren't working all that great. And sometimes they'd see it. Sometimes they'd see one card and they mm-hmm. were trying to announce it live and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. That was miserable to watch as a casual mm-hmm. poker player. I'm sure yeah. it was probably fascinating for like experience.
I don't think anybody likes that. I don't think anybody likes it when there's only one card. I mean, yeah, there's the idea of like, oh, it's kind of cool. We can try to figure it out along with the other players. And it's like, not really. It's nope. not really that
just
interesting.
Play regular poker.
Yeah. I don't know if I've brought this up. The interesting thing about, poker in the last year or so, the biggest story that came out of poker was this guy on a live stream who was cheating. And somebody, because the stream is what was the stream called? It was some place in like California. It was like whatever, but there was this one guy named Mike Possel who kept like winning and kept doing these amazing fucking folds and amazing, like, you know, shoves all in when he doesn't have anything, but the other person doesn't have anything and all this. And it's like, and you know, the announcer's like, "Oh my God, he's so amazing. What in the hell?" And, this one announcer, Veronica something, when I saw like every poker vlogger went over these hands that Mike Possel played. And, she was one of the original who was like, "Oh yeah, this is awesome. How in the world is he doing that?" And then finally there was one play that just did not make sense at all. Hmm. And she, on the stream, you can see her go, "What the hell's happening? What is this?" Wow. She's like, what the fuck? Huh. Like, and this other guy's like, "Oh my God. Oh my God." And she's like, this doesn't make any sense. Huh. I don't get it. And so apparently she had gone to the powers that be and they were like, "Oh, he's not cheating. He's not cheating." Somebody was in on it because what you see on all of these hands that are amazing is he keeps looking down at his crotch and he's got like his phone down there. And there were numerous like theories about how he was getting it, because you can tap that feed. If you were a scrupulous person, you can tap that feed into somebody's phone if you wanted, if they knew the IP address. And, and so like they were feeding him that. And so there were, they showed numerous hands where it was just like, you know, everybody who's an expert was just like, and yeah, and you can't deny that either, even if you're not an expert. Once they lay it out for you, like, there's just no way that somebody can do this. But this all happened around the same time that you had the Astros cheating with their camera scandal and all that. And it was like, you know, you had a whole bunch of stuff going on all at once. If you had these kind of interests, we're like, man, it's kind of easy to cheat in some of these things.
So the implication is that he had the stream going and he could hear what other people
he could see their whole cards.
He
because,
could actually see them. I see.
Yeah. Although I think now I'm trying to think if, yeah, I think that's what it was. Because there was something about the graphics though. I don't know. Maybe it's either that he could see that or somebody was telling him what they had. And and those card readers, when they don't do the camera stuff anymore, they do this, thing where the card has a chip in them and the really? Chip tells the broadcast what the card is. And sometimes they mess up because certain cards get mixed in with others and whatever. But, yeah, this guy did this for a long time. And I remember even seeing shows before this came out. I remember seeing shows where people, poker vloggers, were like, "Man, this guy to my left, Mike Possel, he's fucking relentless. I don't know how the hell to beat this guy." Cause yeah, there's just moments that you wouldn't play like this ever unless you knew what the cards were.
Hey, Jeremy, before we start, did they outlaw TV watchers from calling in rules violations for golf? Or is that still going on?
I think it's tournament by tournament basis. Like the Ryder Cup, it was specifically not allowed.
Because that was a thing for a second, right? Where like almost every tournament, there was somebody calling in.
I haven't seen that in a while. Perhaps they banned it across the board. I just know at Ryder Cup, Harris English had his putter grip inspected by rules officials because it was all raggedy. It's probably like a 25-year-old grip, falling apart and stringy. And the article I read said, we know it has to have been one of his competitors that turned him in because the tournament wasn't allowing fans to call rules violations in. So one of the European players had to have gone to a rules official and said, I want you to check that putter. Anyway, I thought that was interesting.
What the fuck is he going to do with this putter? Does he have stick'em on there or something like that? Would that even help?
No. No, and I don't think he had any penalty assessed. I think
that's not the point of the whole thing, but I'm just saying, like, I don't even know what.
I mean, it could simply have just been gamesmanship, right? Like, just trying to throw him off his game with a little, you know, anxiety bomb or something where but, you know, I think it's just the equipment has to be in X amount of good shape is the rule. And if you can fuck with your opponent by getting his putter thrown out, why not? I don't know.
At least it's not a fucking viewer. Because, yeah, you'd see, like, people with HD or 4K TVs that are like, yeah, Tiger's ball moved an inch when he moved that leaf.
And they've changed a lot of those rules recently, too. Like, if you're practice swinging on the tee and accidentally hit your ball, no penalty. Put your ball down.
I'm going to apply that a lot then.
Yeah. Well, and you can even, like, because Phil Mickelson was basically groundskeeping around his ball at the Champions Tour last weekend.
That he just won, right?
And the ball moved, but he wasn't assessed a penalty. So, and especially on the green now, you can do anything you want to the green. You can tamp it down with your putter to make spots flat. You can, anyway, they've relaxed a lot of those rules. I bet everybody loves listening to us talk about golf rules.
Listen, they do enjoy us talking about sperm on the greens.
Mm-hmm.
I think you're reaching, but okay.
Look, what happens sometimes it accidentally comes out.
Yep. Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Somebody's got to putt through it.
Back it up. Beep. Mm-hmm. Beep.
Yeah.
Beep.
Yeah.
Not when you get around to it now.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
That's from Dusk Till Dawn. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
I will almost never recognize quotes from that movie.
I always forget if it's spelled T-I-L or T-I-L-L. I think it's T-I-L-L.
It is T-I-L-L.
Yeah, he likes to do weird spellings, like Inglourious Bastards.
Mm-hmm. That's incorrect, right? Till with two L's is incorrect grammatically.
Because,
there, right?
Yeah, till is some other. Yeah, like, T-I-L-L is
with the soil.
Yeah.
Yeah, T-I-L is the contraction of until.
Yes, it is.
And so, but till should never be used in a certain, at all, in that sort of context.
Ever. Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah. I mean, it's not anything anybody's going to really notice unless you're, you know, an English major or something. But yeah, he did it with Inglourious Bastards and then, you know, claimed it was because, you know, Brad Pitt character Aldo Raine is illiterate. And I'm like, well, yeah, but what is that? How does that add to anything?
Was that the reason?
Something of that nature is the reason why Inglourious Bastards was misspelled. It's almost like he misspelled it on his own and somebody was like, that's wrong. And he's like, well, no, that's Aldo Raine. It's like the, why is the Band-Aid on the back of Marcellus Wallace's neck? It's like, well, I don't know. And then somebody was like, I think the suitcase has his soul in it. And everybody, and he's like, oh, well, that's what it is. Well, it's covering up the scar where they took out his soul.
Cause that everything else about that movie suggests damn it. Man, we go too far sometimes. We really do as film fans. Like, we make up these theories. Inception is the worst, but yeah, I've heard the suitcase has his soul. Like, why can't we just accept that he's playing with us and it doesn't matter what's in the suitcase? It's what it represents. God, I don't.
Yeah, it's better that it's a secret, that it's something so valuable that we don't know what it is.
You don't want to know, is what you're saying.
I'm saying it makes more sense that it's a bunch of gold bricks than it's a human being's soul. Give me a break. Have you seen a Tarantino movie? Has he ever, like, does he do souls? Is that what he does?
Does, no. Like, mystic shit.
Does he do souls? Souls, it's not his thing, man.
Well, and plus, everybody who opens it has got an idea of what it is when they open it. And like, it's not like you open up something and go, oh my God, is that what I think it is? Somebody's soul?
Yeah. Like, hey, that's that dude's soul that I don't even know, right?
That's right. That's right.
Is that a soul? My God, I thought it was
been ages since I've seen
it's
one.
It's been a while.